Good afternoon. After lunch, you're all sleepy. The subject of this conference is human and machine working as a team, and the topic of my talk is when that stops to work. I want to talk about computer security. If you look at security conferences today, the research that's reported is largely about how to break into systems and how to mitigate those problems. System developers deserve more than that. They need a discipline that would allow them to make trade-offs in deciding what defenses to deploy and how to structure their systems. And they need a way to build systems that won't have vulnerabilities. I'm going to talk about the first, that is, an engineering discipline for building secure systems. And engineering is based on science. So what I'd like to do today is talk about what the science base would be for creating this engineering discipline we all need so badly. I'm going to use the term science in the sense that the physicists use it. That is, it's a body of laws, and they're something that allows you to predict some things of interest. Science hasn't always meant that. If you go back 100 years, science was the set of truths that you didn't refute by performing experiments. And even before that, science was any organized body of knowledge. The first definition works for religion and physics. The second definition works for physics. And the third definition works for physics and computer science. So for the purpose of this talk, we'll take science to mean a body of laws. If you think about it, though, a stack of source code is, in fact, a body of laws. It would allow you to predict how a system will behave. And yet, I don't think you'd believe that a body of source code is really a set of laws. This is because we'd like the laws not only to be predictive, but to have some form of generality. They should transcend specific systems. So the source code would describe a single system. We'd like laws that describe Windows and Linux and iOS and every other system that's out there. The physicists often devise laws that don't scale up to real settings. They can understand how a hydrogen atom will perform, but they can't understand how a sugar molecule will perform. Yet we need laws that will be applicable to real settings. And if we're lucky, these laws will provide some sort of explanatory value. They will force us to articulate models that allow us to ignore irrelevant details and focus on the important ones. They will elucidate connections between mechanisms that allow us to understand the consequences of decisions that we make. So this is, if you will, my specification for what the laws must satisfy for them to be useful. The enterprise can be viewed in terms of three levels. We start with a model. Laws are derived for the model. The model idealizes reality. And we must convince ourselves that the model is a reasonable approximation of reality. So the set of mental tools we might use to derive laws from models are going to be the familiar ones from mathematics, logic, game theory, and so on. Whereas the way to establish that a model is an accurate description of reality is about doing measurement and experiments. Only if you do both sets of obligations will you have confidence that the laws are predictive in a useful way? In this talk, I'm only going to focus on the top part. I'm only going to focus on the connection between laws and models. This is an entirely personal decision. It happens to be where I know best. But don't take the fact that I'm ignoring the bottom half of the picture as an indication that it's unimportant. So we look for laws that allow us to predict things, and the question you might ask is, what will we predict? What should the laws be about? I submit that the business of cybersecurity is a business about attacks, defenses, and policies. We want to understand the connections between classes of policies, classes of attacks, and classes of defenses. And the kinds of relationships that these laws will expose are things that tell us what class of policies some class of defenses might defend against, or what is the power of combining one class of defenses and another class. Is it stronger? Is it weaker? Is it the same? And so on. So the vocabulary out of which we will construct these laws is attacks, defenses, and policies. These are not new terms, and what I'd like to do is spend a few minutes looking at what the cybersecurity literature thinks about these terms, partly as a way of educating you, and partly as a way of convincing you that there are many interesting challenges, namely devising good classes of policies, attacks, and defenses. So let's start with classes of policies. A policy is something that says what the system should do and what it should not do. The general way this is characterized is in terms of confidentiality, integrity, and availability, the so-called CIA trilogy. Guess what government agency invented it? So confidentiality is about what you're allowed to learn, integrity is about what you're allowed to change, and availability ensures you're allowed to do something. On the face of it, these look like they're independent. And if you think about what we would like of a classification of building blocks for policies, we would like to have confidence that knowing something is a kind of policy, knowing that it is confidentiality, say, tells us something more. Perhaps it would tell us how you would enforce it, or perhaps it would tell us how the enforcement interacts with other kinds of policies. So I would argue that having elegant descriptions, even formalizations of them, is not good enough. We need to know that the decomposition exists and that the decomposition is valuable. Unfortunately, confidentiality, integrity, and availability are not such a basis for decomposition. They're not orthogonal. There are many examples. I will give you one. Suppose I would like to keep some data confidential. I could keep it confidential by encrypting it so that it cannot be read. I could keep it confidential by obliterating it, that is, invalidating its integrity. Now reading it gets you no information. I could keep it confidential by depriving clients of access to the service. That means by compromising availability. So I just argued that you could achieve confidentiality either with ordinary means or with integrity violations or with availability compromises. If these three terms were orthogonal, I would not be able to do that. So while the world views security policies in terms of these building blocks, I conjecture they are unlikely to be useful building blocks when we create a science of security, because they do not deliver value when you decompose things. Recall its classes of policies, attacks, and defenses. Let's talk a bit about classes of attacks. Attacks are done on a system, so let me start by giving an abstract characterization of a system. My characterization needs to have the property that anything you could imagine as a system satisfies this definition, and it doesn't accidentally rule out classes of attacks. So we'll take the abstraction of a system as a set of interfaces and some specification that defines how they work. The interfaces are the only way to learn about the state of the system or change the state of the system. Notice some interfaces may be hidden. Adi Shamir's talk was about many hidden interfaces. The fact that the interfaces are hidden doesn't make them not present, and we would like to know that any new attack anyone invents by using a side channel or otherwise is covered by this definition. It is. So once we have a definition of a system, then we can define an attack simply as an input or a set of inputs to some interfaces that cause the specification to be violated. I believe this is a general useful definition, but now we come to the problem of defining classes. The literature talks about classes of attacks in a mechanistic way, like buffer overflow attacks or control flow hijacking attacks. That's not a very useful class if you're interested in building a theory around it. It just tells what the attacker does. Better classes would have some interesting structure. So the class of policies that could be disrupted, for example, DOS attacks because they disrupt availability properties, or the set of interfaces that were involved, so for example, side channel attacks because they attack interfaces that most programmers ignore, and so on. So classes of attacks are problematic, but there are some good examples. Finally, defenses. The usual notion of a defense is that it's a means to ensure that some policy gets satisfied. So we control access to a file to ensure that the wrong people don't read or change the file. But that's a mechanistic definition. If we're interested in how to structure systems, we might think in terms of defenses as how you relocate what you trust. You have a system, you don't trust it because certain inputs will cause it to misbehave, so you add a defense. The aggregate now behaves better, but what you did is you became able to trust the system because you trust that the defense works. So relocation of trust is an interesting way to look at defense, and it begs a hard question. Once you talk about relocating trust, then you realize that trust is never created. It's just moved around. You move it someplace where you're more comfortable. And those of you who have studied physics know there are other things like this, conservation laws. And so it's easy to wonder if there's some kind of a conservation law about trust. Look at the literature, and there are many, many defense mechanisms. I've been trying to write a textbook, and it's forced me to try to characterize them. And the categorization I have, that's they're either monitoring or isolation, or they work by doing independence, an action against one doesn't affect something else, or by asymmetry, if you don't know a secret, it's expensive to compute, seem to be a broad set of classes that handle everything. But I have no way to prove that this list is complete, and I have no way to prove that these elements are orthogonal. And so I find it slightly unsatisfying, but what I've done is laid out an interesting challenge. So we've talked about classes of policies, attacks, and defenses. what would science of security laws look like? What I'd like to do is give you some examples. There are many more examples than I will be able to cover today, but perhaps with a few examples, you'll get a flavor. The first set of examples dates from the very beginning of computer security. Computer security started in the mid-60s when we first started to build time-sharing systems. With many people using a computer, there was concern that one person could disrupt or steal secrets from another. And two of the early time-sharing systems were CTSS and a system built by Dennis and Van Horn at MIT. CTSS introduced the idea of an access control list. Associated with each object was a list, the access control list, of all the principals that were allowed to access the object. Your experience with operating systems today, where you change read and write privileges in Linux, or you go to the Windows security page and change who is allowed to access a file, that's access control lists. Capabilities, which was in this Dennis and Van Horn system, took a different view. It associated with each agent, with each process, a list of objects it was allowed to access. And so, in the late 60s, there was this debate. Is access control list better? Are capabilities better? Do they allow you to do the same things? In 1971, Butler Lamson, in trying to explain this all, arrived at the model of a matrix where the rows correspond to principles and the objects correspond to, and the columns correspond to objects. So an access control list described who could access what. Capabilities are a deconstruction of this list, associating a row with each principal. Access control lists are a deconstruction of this structure, associating a column with each object. So this model, trivial as it may seem, established that capabilities and access control lists had the same expressive power. It caused us to be liberated from these implementation details. It created an abstraction that allowed us to have discourse at a higher level. When an operating system runs, people give each other access rights. And you can characterize the operating system in terms of how rights propagate in this access control matrix. You might wonder, is it possible for Alice to accidentally get access to a given file? That is, after all, the central security question you would have when you're configuring a system. Harris, Ruzzo, and Ullman asked this question in 1975. Is it possible for the access control matrix to evolve in a way that allowed a given principal access to an object? And they had good news and bad news and wonderful news. The good news was, for some simple systems, that was a decidable question. You could write an algorithm that checked. The bad news is, you couldn't write a single algorithm that would check all complicated systems. It was an undecidable problem. It was just as hard as debugging a program. And the proof was by reduction. And the great news was, this is the first non-trivial result that establishes a relationship between access control mechanisms. And so we can start to populate our landscape with results. Let's look at another example. And for this, I'd like you to reflect on how physics has evolved. When Newton wrote his laws of motion, things didn't move that fast. And his laws of motion apply to things that are not moving fast. And so meter sticks don't shrink. Einstein worried about what happens when things move fast. And he wrote a set of laws of motion that allow very fast things to move, and meter sticks shrink when they move in the direction of motion. Newton's laws are a special case of Einstein's laws. when speed is low. But what happened is we moved to a richer domain. We scaled up out of sub-100 mile per hour speeds, and the structure of the physics changed. I've had an experience like that in security. There is a well-known theory of information flow, and it's qualitative. It concerns how information that one principal might have can flow to another principal. It was developed by Bell and LaPadula in the 70s, and a fellow named Kem Baiba extended it from confidentiality to integrity. Think of this as Newton's laws of motion. If you have a qualitative set of laws, you might also wonder about quantitative things. How many bits can leak, as opposed to does anything leak? So let's look at how this would be. This picture depicts confidentiality and integrity. The top is confidentiality. It's concerned with preventing secret information from flowing to an attacker. The bottom picture is about integrity. It's concerned with preventing untrusted information from flowing to a user, as opposed to trusted information. So in both cases, the security enforcement mechanism implements that red X. Michael Clarkson and I had a way to compute the rate at which information leaked in the top picture. So we reasoned we could use that same rate at the bottom picture, because the bottom picture is the dual of the top picture. And if we did that, we would have a way to bound how quickly integrity erodes, just as we had bounded how quickly confidentiality erodes. Well, it turns out we were now in relativistic speeds. The picture at the bottom shows what happens. The attacker inputs untrusted information, and the extent to which that corrupts the stuff that is emitted by the program could be called contamination, and it is the dual of leakage. But there's another phenomenon. Because of actions the attacker takes, some information from the user may get lost. We could call that suppression. That's not accounted for in the confidentiality picture, and that's the equivalent of the Lorentz contraction that Einstein had to worry about when meter sticks were moving quickly. So you can work out the numbers, and in fact, we worked them out for a special case. We worried about the case where there was no contamination, only suppression. And the reason is any program that controls access to a database to prevent the flow of the leakage of confidential information actually works like this kind of an integrity program. And there's a simple theorem. This theorem in terms of leakage plus suppression equals a constant is not a PowerPoint piece of mathematics. It's real mathematics. It's a real plus. I just didn't work out for you the details of the expression for leakage and suppression. But what this theorem says is if you suppress more, less leaks. There's that kind of a trade-off. In retrospect, it's a trivial theorem, but it was derived by working from first principles from the model. And once you have it, it turns out that this is the theorem that can explain the bounds in just about all of the database protection mechanisms that have been proposed. So one theorem, and you get the main results in several papers. Okay, so I've just populated our landscape with examples of laws that are about policies. Let me look at one more example with you, and that's execution monitoring. One of the earliest enforcement mechanisms comes in 1972 in the Anderson Report, and it's called a reference monitor. The idea is this reference monitor intercepts every event, checks if it's allowed to proceed. If it is, it allows it. If it isn't, it blocks the program. Reference monitors appear in operating systems. Virtual memory mapping boxes are reference monitors. Firewalls are reference monitors. It is very pervasive. It's upsetting to reflect that even in 2000, nobody had asked the question, what is the class of policies you can enforce with a reference monitor? Perhaps it was because everyone thought any policy could be enforced. So to answer that question, you can reflect on what are the essential attributes of the way this mechanism works. First, it only looks at a single execution that's going on. It doesn't look at alternative possible executions. It just looks at what's happened. And second, because it looks at what's happened, it can only reject based on seeing a prefix of a computation. The set of sequences that correspond to reject on prefix is known in the concurrency literature as a safety property. All properties are the conjunction of safety properties and liveness properties. So what you should realize is there are apparently lots of things that reference monitors cannot enforce. So examples of things that are safety properties, so can be enforced, include whether you can read a file. Examples of things that cannot be enforced are things like your guaranteed service. Because after a prefix has occurred, if you haven't gotten service, it doesn't mean you won't next get it. So availability cannot be enforced precisely using a reference monitor. Nor can information flow, because information flow is about the correlation between values. And to check for a correlation, you have to look at multiple executions at the same time. So right away, we now have a way for you to tell your boss, who walks into your office and says, I want you to add this to the operating system kernel. You can say, no, I can't. Nobody will ever enforce that by fixing any operating system kernel because it's a reference monitor, and we're way ahead. Another result that falls out of this safety property characterization is that all safety properties correspond to automata that accept them. The automata is essentially the reference monitor. And you know that an automata can be characterized by its next state transition, which just looks at the next symbol and decides whether a transition is allowed or not. And once we've constructed this piece of code, we have a new way to enforce safety policies. We can put a copy of that code in front of every instruction, rewriting a program to make it so that it's self-enforcing. Of course, that's going to make the program much, much longer. But if you take that much extended program and feed it to an optimizer, the optimizer can delete all the steps that are unnecessary. And the result is a program that only checks the things that it needs to check to work on the policy you want enforced. That turns out to be efficient. So now we can look at monitor options that were exposed by doing this characterization. And we know we can start with a safety property. You can't enforce anything else with a reference monitor. You could build the automaton from a description of the property. And then there are a variety of implementation options. You could use a single centralized reference monitor. That's what's done today. You could inline the reference monitor. Some people have done that. And you could use analysis to delete the unnecessary checks. That means if you start with a program that satisfies the policy, a good analyzer will delete all the checks, and you'll end up with the program you started with. Why should you believe that program is secure? You shouldn't. You want to know that the right checks were added and the right checks were deleted. So that means the way you add the checks and delete the checks needs a proof. And so the program accompanied by a proof should be sufficient for you to believe that you're enforcing the policy, even though there's no mechanism. This is called proof-carrying code, and it was developed by a graduate student working under the supervision of Peter Lee. We could look at reference monitors in another way, in terms of relocating trust. So our view is you want to trust the program. If you add a reference monitor, you don't have to trust the program, but you have to trust the reference monitor. If you use a centralized reference monitor, you have to trust that it gets the invocation stuff works. It gets invoked when it should. If you inline a reference monitor, you don't have to trust the invocation stuff, but you have to trust the program that added the code, the inlining tool, or you have to trust a proof checker. So by structuring things in this way, I hope I've given you some insight into the trade-offs associated with different deployments of reference monitors. So we can position this on our map as about relating defenses and policies. So if you reflect on what I've talked about, you might realize that everything I've said has come out of some computer science class that you have taken or you should have taken. And so you can wonder, is there a science of security or is it just computer science? If it's just computer science, then we're all set. And if it's not just computer science, then we've got some work to do. So there are three pieces of computer science that people often exclaim as being the basis for the science of security. I'd like to look at them. The first isn't this just formal methods and refinement? All this discussion about safety properties and reference monitors and simplification is just what software engineers do when they work in formal methods. So let's look carefully at how formal methods are practiced today. An example of a rule from formal methods is the rule that lets you do refinement. You regard a program as defining a set of sequences. You define a property as defining a set of sequences. And you say the program satisfies the property if the program, a set, is a subset of the property. Because then every execution the program is capable of is in the property. When you refine a program, you rule out possible executions. And so refinement is subset. So this theorem says refinement preserves properties. But let's look carefully at what it really says. First, it says this holds only if you can represent properties and programs as sets of sequences. Sequences are not all that rich, and sets of sequences are not all that rich either. In fact, you can't define confidentiality in terms of a set of sequences. You can't define confidentiality in terms of a set of executions that are allowed. I said this earlier. In order to do correlation, in order to characterize information flow, you need to look at two sequences to make sure that values in one change in a way that's correlated with the way they change in another. So this representation in terms of sets of sequences is not rich enough to handle confidentiality. You need something richer. Sets of sequences, so-called hyperproperties, would be rich enough. Trees would be rich enough. But the formal methods community has not been using those bases for their formal methods. So we need them to redo 40 years of development work, starting with something richer than sets of sequences. And it would be wonderful if they did it, and if they don't do it, we have to do it. But it's why formal methods is not going to be the science of security unless we start anew with a different basis. A second area that people say is really the basis for security is fault tolerance. Fault tolerance is about building systems that work despite failures of a given class. And one of the most hostile classes of failures is known as the Byzantine failure class. Byzantine failures do arbitrary damage, and perhaps in correlated ways. If you build a system that is Byzantine fault tolerant, then nothing can cause it to fail. Usually you build a system that can tolerate up to some number T of Byzantine failures. In that case, as many as T faults can happen before the system will fail. And there's a rich, rich literature on Byzantine fault tolerance. When you look carefully, it typically involves taking a service or a system and replicating it. The same inputs are sent to all the replicas. All the replicas deterministically process these, and so all the replicas that are not faulty produce the same outputs. You vote on those outputs. Provided a majority of the replicas have not been compromised, the majority inputs to the voter will agree, and you will get a correct answer. Airplanes use Byzantine fault tolerance for their flight computers. So since Byzantine failures allow anything to go, an attacker can't do anything worse than a Byzantine failure. And so you'd like to believe that we could just use the theory of Byzantine fault tolerance as a basis for a science of cybersecurity. Again, we need to look carefully at the assumptions. First of all, by replicating a system, you don't make the confidentiality problem any easier. Now there are more places the attacker can go for your secret. So Byzantine fault tolerance works for integrity, but it doesn't work for confidentiality. And there's one other issue. The assumption when people build fault tolerant systems is that physically separated boxes fail independently. An alpha particle strikes one, but won't strike the other at the same time. This independence of failure is the thing that allows you to conclude that the probability a majority of the boxes will be compromised is arbitrarily small. But if you replicate code that has a vulnerability, then you've made it easy on the attacker. The same attack will work against every replica. The replicas are not independent. There's an independence assumption that makes sense for fault tolerance. It makes no sense for security. And so this Byzantine fault tolerance can't work for security unless we can deal with independence. Look at the literature of Byzantine fault tolerance, and you find nobody worries about independence. Some people mention the need, but nobody wonders about how to achieve it. The third subdiscipline of computer science, and last one, that people assert might be the science of security is cryptography. Cryptography is a beautiful subject, and there are many elegant results. In fact, there's not one science of cryptography, but two. The one that Shannon invented and the one that the computer scientists invented based on computational complexity. The reason cryptography is not the science of security is it only handles limited sets of things. It's not easily adapted to handle arbitrary computations. There are some results about this, but they start with functions. They don't start with a piece of C code that does some ugly thing. And cryptography is limited in the set of mechanisms. So until we're prepared to get in bed with only those mechanisms, which means ignoring the idea of using isolation or reference monitors or rewriting, as a basis for enforcement, unless we want to abandon those, then cryptography will be silent on how they work. And so cryptography is not sufficiently broad, nor is it likely to get that way. So it's wonderful, but it's not the answer. What I hope you will conclude is that computer science could be the science of security. But for that to happen, we need to extend computer science. We need to figure out a theory for independence of components. We need to come up with a semantics that's richer than sets of sequences. We need to revisit information theory. Shannon's information theory thinks that all bits cost the same. But it really matters which bits you leak in many settings. And in fact, Shannon's notion of entropy is not always the right notion of entropy for looking at information flow and leakage. And there's a whole family of kinds of entropies that have been evolved. So there are opportunities to scale up computer science to make it be the science of security. But understand, it's very much like what happened with Einstein. We're taking Newton's laws, computer science, adding more fidelity, and the rules change. So here's our map again. I've tried to populate it with the results I've talked about. There are other science results, and in other versions of this talk, I sometimes talk about those too. But there aren't that many others. My hope is that you now have some feel for what a science of security result looks like. And it's not that you sit down and say, I want to prove a new law. What's more likely is you do something in security, you build a mechanism, and you should stop and ask yourself, okay, what's the general question I should ask to understand the role of this mechanism in this map? So I don't sit and invent laws, I sit and solve problems, but I have found most problems have lurking under them interesting science questions. And if we do develop these laws, then we can equip developers with a basis to make decisions about the systems they are building rather than forcing them to add mitigations because attacks have been discovered. This is a list of the papers that I borrowed from for this talk. I'll leave this up here, and I hope I have inspired you to ask a different kind of questions, and I've convinced you that the notion of a science of security is a legitimate body of work. Thank you.